I suppose you know why the school was created. And it was created by parents who were very dissatisfied with what was going on in the public schools, not only because of the busing problem. As a matter of fact, I wrote a book back in 1971, How to Start Your Own Private School and Why You Need It. And it was about the entire movement for private schools, that is, the general discontent with public education. And particularly in the South, where they had a tremendous upheaval. And I visited many schools all over the country, and but little did I realize or even dream that things would develop in the Boston area that would motivate parents to do the same things that the parents did in the South. But the most important thing I pointed out in the book was that the busing problem was really a minor problem compared to all the other problems that are going on in the schools, particularly the instruction problems, the decline in academic standards, the increase in functional literacy. I'm sure you're all aware of that. I don't have to tell you. I've got more documentary proof on that than you would want to look at. But I'm sure you read the newspapers as well. Now, a private school has to compete with both the public schools and other private schools. Now, South Boston Heights Academy wants to grow. It wants to become a school not only known for its independence and, how would you say, its own personality, but also for its academic achievements. It wants to be known as a good school because it wants to grow and draw pupils from other parts of the city, because this school will have a great deal to offer in a very short period of time, in a couple of years. So our growth depends on being an excellent school, you see, drawing children from all over. And that's why we've inaugurated the Curriculum Development Department, because we realize that in the early stages of development, the school is so busy getting itself settled physically that it really can't worry too much about the academic aspects of it. But now that we've gotten basically most of the physical problems worked out, now we have to work on the academic aspects of it. Now, when I wrote this book, I spent 18 months substitute teaching in the schools of Quincy. That's high schools and the junior high schools. And I was appalled at the changes that had taken place in public education since I had gone to school. Now, all of you are all young people. You've grown up in the younger generation. Of course, I can't expect you to compare it to anything before that, to what went on, say, when I went to school, or even people not as old as I am. But the changes were just so drastic, I couldn't believe it. Now, we have been aware of the reading problem since at least 1955. That's when, how many of you have heard of Rudolf Flesch's book? How many of you have heard of Rudolf Flesch? All right. Rudolf Flesch was the man who wrote the famous book, Why Johnny Can't Read. And he wrote that, but when do you think that book was published? Do you have any idea when it was published?
1955.
Yes. It was published in 1955. That's when you were 5 years old.
Was
how old were you?
I was born. Just being
oh,
born.
You were born in 1950. Well, so you see. All right. So we've been aware of this problem, of the reading problem, as early. That was the first big book to come out and make Americans aware of what had happened. And everybody was asking, why can't Johnny read? Well, Dr. Flesch explained it very simply. He says, because they've changed the method of teaching in the schools. That's why. Everyone who went to school before, I learned how to read. everyone in my class learned how to read. There's no problem when I went to school, you see. But parents were unaware of what had gone on in the schools because the methods had been changed without their knowledge. They were not consulted. They were not asked. The educators, the professors of education at Framingham State, and BU, and Harvard, Columbia, had decided to change the way of teaching children to read. So we knew that there was a reading problem in 1955. In 1961, a lawyer in New York, Watson Washburn, founded the Reading Reform Foundation. The purpose of the foundation was to get the schools back to teaching reading the way it had been taught before the method had been changed. Now, you might ask, what was the change in the method? The change in the method was from the alphabetic phonics method to the look-say hieroglyphic method, look-say, sight, whole word method. That was the big change. And it was very crucial. Now, Watson Washburn created the Reading Reform Foundation in 1961. At that time, I was living in New York City, and I knew him well, and he asked me to become a member of his National Advisory Committee. So I became a member of his National Advisory Board and became interested in the reading problem in 1961. Now, when I was teaching in the schools of Quincy in 1970, I was amazed that the reading problem still existed. I thought that because of Rudolf Flesch's book, and because of the Reading Reform Foundation and other protests by parents that things had changed, but they haven't. In fact, they were getting worse. So after that, I wrote a book. I told my publisher, I said, look, how would you like a book that would bring the reading problem up to date, the reading situation? Because after Rudolf Flesch's book came out in 55, there was a book in 1964, I believe, by Dr. Jean Schall. Now, that book I'm sure you're aware of. Can you tell me the name of that book? Right. She said virtually the same thing that Dr. Flesch said, but she said it in terms more acceptable to the hierarchy, to the educational hierarchy. She said, phonics, you have to start with phonics. But at that time also, by then, the linguistics people began to get into the act. And they had their own ideas about how to teach reading. And so that complicated things a little bit. We'll take that up later on. However, I decided to write a book to bring the situation up to date. And this is the book. It's called The New Illiterates. And it was about the growing problem of functional illiteracy and dyslexia, etc., in the United States. And this came out in 1973. So it was up to date, up to 1973. All right, now when you write a book criticizing the teaching of reading in the schools, it's good to come out, follow up a book by showing them how it should be done. So in order to be a positive critic, I wrote this book, How to Tutor, which showed what methods should be used or recommended. What method that can be used to teach children to read without any problems, the alphabetic intensive phonics method. So these are my three books on education. This book also covered reading, writing, and arithmetic, the three R's, as I figured that if a parent wanted to teach the child at home before the child got to school, they could teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now, I've written a book since then called The Retreat from Motherhood, which is a book on the changing attitudes of women in our society, which has nothing to do with this, but I just bring it to your attention in case you're interested in reading it. Anyway, I have been connected with the Reading Reform Foundation since 1961. I became the chairman, the Massachusetts chairman of the Reading Reform Foundation, about I'd say in 72, so about 6 years ago, I became the master's chairman. We haven't been very active, but we intend to become more active. Now, in that time, I gave two speeches to the Reading Reform Foundation's annual conferences, the conference of 1974 and 75, and they are in this booklet, and I'm going to give each of you a copy so that you could see my views on the subject. We'll discuss them orally, too. But what I would like you to do now, why don't you look at that later on, okay, when you're at home. What I wanted to say was that the major problem, the most important problem in American education today is reading instruction. It's at the heart of all of our problems. It's at the heart of the whole business of so-called reading disability, of dyslexia, of remedial reading, etc. It's the reason why the vocabulary of our young people has shrunken. It's a reason why reading scores have dropped. You see, so this is the problem that we're going to attack first. And since you three teachers are most responsible for the initial teaching, primary school teaching, I suggested to the board of directors that I start at the very beginning, grade one, and then we'll work our way up through the whole school. All right, so now what I would like to ask you to do, the three of you, would now, just off the top of your head, on a little piece of paper, write a definition of the alphabet. A definition of the alphabet. You have it.
That's a good one. Yeah, I know it.
You have it? Let me read it.
I had a cold.
All right, well, let me see what I said. Alphabet includes the letter symbols A to Z. All right, now what do you... All right, the alphabet, the letters from A to Z, which we use to write words. And what is yours?
I said code.
Well, what do you write? But it's just code. Just the code. All right. Well, I would say that these are partially correct. Yes, it's true. They are the letters from A to Z. But it doesn't exactly describe what those symbols stand for, you see. So, you see... You're all products of the education you've had. No question about it. That's the way it is, you know. And our purpose here is to give you something which you didn't get in your schools. Now, let's start, for example, with the whole business of writing. What was the first sort of writing that existed when man started writing? Can you think of what was the first, what was the first form of writing? Pictures, right, pictography. This is the way it was. For example, I'll give you an idea of what pictography is. Pictography, for example, what is this? What do you think of this? Huh? Right, it looks like a tree. You can't mistake it for anything else, right? Mm-hmm. It's a tree. That was a symbol. That's a simple pictograph. It stands for a tree, and you can't mistake it. All right, now let me give you... the first form of writing was pictography. You didn't have to go to school to learn how to read. You just looked at the picture, and it said tree. You knew it was a tree, you see. But this was a very limited form of writing, because how do you make a symbol for the word is? you see. Or a symbol for the word art or happiness, you know. In other words, the only thing you could write with symbols like this are concrete things. A tree, a house. Those are the things you could write. So then we developed into a more complicated form of writing. For example, we developed hieroglyphics. Now, let me show you first a hieroglyphic with a pure ideograph. What is this? What does it look like to you?
Bed,
right. It's a bed. All right, now what is this?
Hospital.
Huh? All right, now, what do you think this would mean if I put this together in a circle? What word would this mean to you?
Bedtime.
Right.
Bedtime.
Bedtime. But you see, that's easy enough to guess, right? Now, what do you think? Now, here's another word. Using the same symbol. Here's the bed. And then here's a little animal, a little curly animal with curly fur. What would that mean? What is this word? Huh? Bed. Well, this one up here is bed time. This would be bed. Once an animal with little curly fur or wool.
Bed sheet.
No. What's another word for lamb? Now put those together. What do you get?
Bedlam.
What's bedlam mean? Pardon? Right. It's like a madhouse. Bedlam. So, but you see, this does not look like that at all. That's what hieroglyphics were. They were the use of symbols that did not look like what they represented. So then you had to go to school to learn. Somebody had to tell you. You see. So that was the second step in the evolution of writing, you see. Now, all of these things, if you'll notice, this represents a tree, a concrete of a tree. And this represents ideas of a clock. For example, you could say bedtime, time to go to bed. You could read this time for bed. It's not related to any specific words. It's a general symbol. It says bedtime, it's time to go to bed, etc. Mixed, this is a mixed ideograph here. The lamb stands for a sound, not for a lamb. It stands for the sound lamb. So we're using a lamb, a picture of a lamb, simply because we want to get something to represent the sound of the word lamb. So that's why hieroglyphics was more complicated. Because you had to be taught what symbols stood for what. You could read ideographs without any trouble, but hieroglyphics you had to learn. Now, let's try another interesting word. What is this? What is this now?
Tree.
What is this?
Treason.
Treason, right. Treason. Now, if you'll notice, the word and the symbols do not look like one another. You'd never know that this was treason. In other words, these are sound symbols. So in other words,
hieroglyphics was approaching the idea of a sound symbol system. That is, symbols to represent sounds. But then all of a sudden, somebody invented the alphabet. Now, what happened? Why was the alphabet so important? Now, why was the alphabet so different from the others? Pardon?
It was like a unicorn code.
Well, the interesting thing about the alphabet was this. You see, you had to have hundreds and thousands of different symbols for words. For every word, you needed different sets of symbols. But the alphabet, all you needed was 24, 26, or 30, depending on the language. Now, what was the great discovery behind the alphabet? First of all, they needed a method of writing that represented the spoken word. Because as civilization was getting more complicated, you couldn't use these symbols. They were too difficult to learn 1,000 symbols or 5,000 symbols. You see, you had to learn each symbol separately. That took too long. So the great discovery behind the invention of the alphabet was the discovery that all of human speech, that is everything you say, can be reduced to about 44 or 45 irreducible voice sounds or speech sounds. Now there are more than that for the entire gamut of speech sounds. For example, there are some sounds in the Russian language which we don't have in English, or in the Chinese language that we don't have in English. But as far as English is concerned, 44 sounds covers everything. So they said, why don't we invent a system whereby we have symbols simply to represent sounds? And so was born the alphabet. Alpha, beta being the first letters of that alphabet. Symbols to represent speech sounds only. Nothing else. All right. Now, when do you think the alphabet was invented? How far back does it go? Does it go back 10,000 years? 50,000? 2,000? When does alphabetic writing start? It started about 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. About the same time when they started writing the Bible, the alphabet was invented. Now that was a fantastic discovery because suddenly it made it possible for people to write, to have to learn very little in order to learn how to write. The first alphabet, we believe, was the Phoenician alphabet. The Phoenicians invented the first alphabet. Then, of course, at that time, you had the Hebrew alphabet and the Greek alphabet. The Greeks were the ones who really took it over and expanded it enormously. Now, what did the alphabet do? The alphabet simply recorded spoken sounds. And in your first written alphabetic writing, they didn't even bother to divide up the words into separate words. They just had a long row of speech sounds. It was like a tape recorder. And you learned how to read all the different sounds. Eventually, they began to break them up into separate words, put spaces between them. Then they added punctuation. Then they added capitals and lowercase. Now, the alphabet among the Greeks had very distinctive names, the letters alpha, beta, gamma, etc. And each letter stood for a sound. Now there's a distinction between the letter name and the letter sound. The name is just the name of the letter, lets you identify it. For example, beta stands for the word house. And I suppose they used that word simply because it began with a B. So you had the element what the symbol stood for in the name, alpha, beta, etc. When it got to Rome, they discarded those names and they began to call them A, B, C. Now, the English adopted the Latin alphabet. So the English did not invent their own alphabet to fit their own language. They adopted somebody else's alphabet. And we adopted the Latin alphabet. Now, the Latin alphabet has 26 letters. Now, how many sounds does our language have? We've got about 44. Some say 45, but I think 44 is pretty accurate. So, we've got 26 letters to stand for 44 sounds. Now, of course, how did the ancients teach the alphabet to the children? How did they teach them to read? They taught them the letter, say we start with A, B, see they said A, P, S, or K, whichever it was. And they drilled them on the letters, their sounds, first in combinations with two letters, like Ba, Be, Bi, Bo, Bu, etc. This was the method that was used for about 2,000 years until American educators decided to change things. Now, the reason why they used this was because they realized that they found out very early that children have to be drilled in the letters because the letters look too much alike. You know, B's and D's, F's and T's, you see. They look too much like, therefore they have to have constant drill. They've got to have a lot of drill before they start to read whole words. So that was the method that was used all the way up until only, say, the last 50 years or so. Now, English developed a special problem. There are some alphabets in the world where they have one letter for one sound. Can you think of one? I'll give you an example. Armenian. Armenian is a perfect alphabet. Armenian has a letter for every sound. They have no problems, you see. But English, we use 26 letters to stand for 44 sounds. So that was the beginning of the problem. And then also, English is a peculiar language because it got a lot of foreign words into it. England was invaded by many different nations, and so it brought in French, Norwegian, you name it. Everything's in English. So you've got, first of all, an inadequate balance, 26 letters to 44 sounds. You've got an invasion of foreign languages into the language, and then you have a lot of archaic changing pronunciations over the centuries. So then you're left with a lot of archaic constructions, spelling constructions, that are no longer pronounced the way they once were. So those are the three problems that we have in English. 26 letters for 44 sounds, the invasion of foreign languages, or the inclusion of foreign, for example, a lot of Latin words we have in English, they're not basically of the old Anglo-Saxon. Basically Latin. And, of course, changing spellings and archaic spellings that remain. So that was the unique problem of English. And, of course, people began to try to find a way to simplify the reading, the teaching of reading to children. They thought, gee whiz, how can we simplify it? They said, well, let's teach them to read whole words. You know, the hell with the alphabet. You know, we don't have to teach them the letters first. Let them recognize the words. So they developed the idea of the so-called sight vocabulary. But then they didn't realize that if you teach children a sight vocabulary, a lot of them are not only going to be very weak in the letters and their understanding of alphabetic writing, but are also not going to know why you have to read from left to right. So what, you know, if to recognize a word, a whole word, you just look at it, so, you know, suppose you recognize by the T first. There's no rule that says, why do you have to read it from this way? Why can't you read it that way? or upside down. So in other words, alphabetic writing depends on left to right reading, because you have to realize that each letter stands for a sound, and they are written in the sequence in which they are pronounced. That's why we read from left to right. So you have to know that you've got to... Alphabetic writing depends on the sequence, left to right sequence. Some other languages have a right to left sequence, like Hebrew goes from right to left. But English goes from left to right. But English goes from, not yet, left to right. And if you know your letters and your letter sounds, you can read a running transcription of speech sounds. Now, of course, when you go back and think of the way they taught reading back in the old days, before they had the printing press, there were no pictures, of course. The letters, the child learned the letters, and he learned the sounds, and these were the pictures, the letters themselves. We didn't begin to get pictures until we had printing, and that was long after we began to have, you know, books. So we have problems with the English alphabetic system. There's no question about it. The problem is how best to teach it, not how to avoid it. And that's what too much modern teaching methods do. They try to go around it, avoid it. Let's go around the alphabet. Let's go around it, you see, rather than to attack the problem head on. Now, anyone who knows, who wants to become highly literate, has to develop an absolute mastery of the alphabetic system. There's no question about it. You can't get around it. The only way you can become a good reader is to know your letters. And the only way you can do that is to, by starting with the alphabet first and by learning what the alphabet is. And so, in teaching children to read, the best way to go about it is first you teach them the alphabet, which I'm sure... you teachers do. You teach them the alphabet. First you teach them the names, the letter names, and to recognize the alphabet letters. So they can draw them. I don't know how you're conducting first grade. You are first grade? Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Most of my kids, surprisingly enough, knew them.
All right, yeah. Most children pick up the alphabet before they get to, even at the first grade. They pick it up at 4 years old. They pick it up from their older sisters. They're exposed to it so often, they learn the alphabets. All right, so it's no great problem to teach them to recognize the letters. But then when you have to start teaching them the letter sounds, the thing is, what's the best way to do it? Now, I believe that it is absolutely wrong to teach a sight vocabulary, because you get them started off on bad habits of reading backwards and forwards, of trying to recognize a word by its shape rather than by its sound. You've got to teach the child to understand the alphabetic idea, what the alphabet is. Here's a definition of the alphabet. The alphabet is a set of graphic symbols, that represent the speech sounds of a given language. That's what an alphabet is. It's a set of graphic symbols representing the speech sounds of a given language. You see. And when you understand that, then the alphabet suggests how itself it should be taught. You see. So, we don't have to do as they did the ancients with the ba, bo, bi. We could make it perhaps a little different. I start in a different way. I start, say, for when you're teaching the letters, with the letter A. This letter stands for, we start with the short A, because you have most of your, you have a lot of very simple, regular words. We have a lot of irregular spellings in English, so we best to start with the regulars. You tell the child that this letter... First of all, you tell the child that the alphabet stands for his speech sounds. It stands for everything he says. He can put down anything he wants on paper once he knows the alphabetic system. That's the beauty of it. 26 letters can do that complete job. 26 letters can represent thousands and thousands and thousands of words. And of course, children come to school knowing thousands of words, being able to speak thousands of words. So all you've got to do is teach them a method whereby they can read those thousands of words. You see, they've got a vocabulary. They come, and they're very smart, these, because they've taught themselves how to speak their own language. From the age of 2 on to 4, they go through a tremendous process of teaching themselves how to read. How to speak. We all went through it. We don't even remember how it was done. But we did it through trial and error, hearing, you see, etc. All right, so now we start. I always believe it's best to start the alphabet from A to A. Some people think you ought to start with other letters. I say, start from the beginning, because eventually the child is going to have to learn the alphabet anyway. He has to know alphabetic in order to look things up in the phone book, etc. So it's best to learn the alphabet from A through it. So we start with A, short A. And we tell him that this symbol, short A, stands for this letter stands for the sound A. A. That's what it stands for, you see. And then what we do, we have two letter, we try to reduce it as much as possible. We try to teach them two letter words. Now, what are the most simple words that we can teach them? We start with am, and, as, at, x. All right, so there you've got one vowel letter, and you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 consonant letters. And you tell them that there's a difference between vowels and consonants. A consonant, you cannot have a word without a vowel sound in it, you see. You can have a word, the word is one letter, but you must have a vowel sound in the language, in any word. So we start out with a, then we teach him the letters, the sounds of, now he knows what an M is. He says, this is M, N, S, T, and X. Now you say, what are the sounds? These are the sounds. M, the sound of M is the M. You say the word am, am. This letter stands for the A, and this letter stands for the M. When you put them together, you get am. You see, two sounds, two letters. Two sounds, two letters. You do the same with the N. Here you use the soft S, as. Soft S, as. T and X. So he learns those words first. An, as, at, X. Now it's very easy that after you've learned those words, starting with those, and here we don't use any pictures, no sight words, we start with the alphabet. Because we want to make sure that they learn the letters and the sounds. So then what we do to expand that, we take the S here and we put it in front here. We get the word Sam. We take the M from there and put it in front here and we get the word man. We teach him another letter, the H, and give him the word has. We take the S and give him sat, and we take the T and we give him tax. So there we've expanded using only one additional letter, teaching him the sound of H. You see, this gets him started. He begins to get an idea of that the letters stand for sounds, that they're repeated in the sequence that they're written. So that's why you read from left to right. They're repeated in the sequence that they're written. And the letters stand for the sound that they hear. Like in the word sat, the S stands for s, the A for a, and the T for the t. That's what the letters stand for. That's what they symbolize. And so he learns what a symbol is, a sound symbol. You explain to him, do you know what a symbol is? What does a green light mean? It means go. That's a symbol. Green light means go. This is a symbol for a speech sound. These are symbols for sounds, you see. And alphabetic writing is a pure sound symbol system. It's the worst way, it's the worst thing to teach it via whole words, and I'll tell you why. After the alphabet was invented, our vocabulary underwent tremendous expansion because suddenly it was so easy to learn how to read. You see, it was much easier. You only had to learn the letters, those 26 letters or whatever. So many, many more words were added to the vocabulary. And your ability to read those words depended on your ability to master the alphabetic system. Now you take Chinese, which is like the hieroglyphics method. The Chinese person has to memorize 5,000 separate symbols. 5,000 separate symbols. So you can imagine how limited their vocabulary is because they just can't remember that much. And the average Chinese must have about 5,000 before he can read a Chinese newspaper. And he must read constantly. That's why I believe that Chinese civilization has been so backward, because they have never really developed a system whereby they can communicate complicated ideas. Any of the Chinese who get anywhere come to the West and learn English. Then they pick up all our ideas in English, then they go back to China. But English, or a Western language, is the language they use because alphabetic writing permitted us to have a tremendous expansion of vocabulary just on the basis of a small letter change. You know, for example, you take a word like bit, bid, bed, bet. Depends on, you know, how could you look at these words and remember them by whole words? What are you going to use? You see, how can you possibly, you've got to know your letters very well, because this is what you've got to read. You've got to read your letters. You've got to know your letters. You can't depend on trying to look, see a picture in a whole word.
Those are the perfect words, so like, yeah. Those are the words that I wouldn't give a sight word.
Of course, right. All right, I want to ask you, how many true sight words are there in English?
Just at least 200.
Well, name them for me. Well, give me a couple of them.
All right.
When you say sight word, I'm not sure exactly what you mean.
Sight word is a word in which the letters do not represent the sounds. They don't represent the sounds that we teach the child.
I know there's like... Well, there's 200 in that they're supposed to know by the end of the first grade that they call sight words.
Ah, they call them sight words.
Some of those you could sound out.
Right. In other words, this whole business of sight reading has been terribly exaggerated. There are very few actual sight words, words that cannot be figured out on the basis of the letters. In most cases, in your exceptional words, it'll be a vowel sound that will vary. The consonants will be perfectly all right. Take, for example, the word, in all of your three-letter short vowel words, I've only found one that was irregular. I wonder if you can think of the word.
Three-letter?
Yeah, it's a three-letter word, one of these.
Oh,
the.
The? That's three-letter.
Well, I mean a short vowel word.
Oh, okay.
But the only one that is the word was. As, has, was. But if you notice, it's only the A that has a slight change in it, you know. It's not so difficult to tell a child. Well, in this case, the word was is an exception. It's irregular.
Now that, when we, on our reading books,
yep.
That W-A, they learn that W-A has a certain sound, what? So it's irregular.
All right, okay, wow.
What do they learn that W is by itself?
W by itself.
Is it one? Is it one?
What? W, I don't know, you haven't gotten that binding before.
It's no, I'm just telling what W is by itself.
W
is one.
Sure, you have
but
to teach
W-A
the...
W-A is one.
Incidentally, you must isolate the sounds. There is a school of thought that says, oh no, you mustn't isolate the sounds. The linguists, for example. The linguists say you must teach them, you shouldn't isolate the sounds. But that's ridiculous, because if you don't, then they miss the whole point of alphabetic writing. The discovery of the alphabet was that you could isolate sounds. That was the beauty of it, you see. And that's what made it so easy and made it so made it possible to use so few letters, is because we were able to isolate the sounds. And therefore, the child should know the meaning of every sound in his alphabet. And he should know that he can articulate them. There's nothing wrong with teaching a child to say book. Yes?
I use the sight words a little bit differently.
How do you use them?
Well, I pick the words that the kids see very often in their books, or it's not necessarily the words that they can't sound out, but I'll give them like 10 sight words every 2 weeks, and they go through them, and even the ones that, there's some that they can sound out, but the reason I had picked them out is so when they're reading in a story, they don't have to take the time to sound those out. I found that it's not as difficult, and it's more enjoyable for them when they have a lot of words in their reading that they recognize by sight, so they don't have to sound those out.
Yes, but as long as they know that the letters in those words stand for sound.
Yeah, they do know that.
And there's no reason why you should, there's no reason not to teach them the sounds that the letters stand for.
Can't we do both? I mean, that's what I'm doing right now.
It depends on to the extent that you use sight words. As I say, there's a danger in sight words.
I use like the sight words as like a supplementary approach, but my main approach, I think, probably in our economy is phonics.
Yeah.
All
right. Well, that's what I suspected, but I do know, because on your papers there, it did say that you use sight vocabulary, mm-hmm. and I want to know to what extent you do, because sight vocabulary can be very dangerous, particularly in your Dick and Jane books, where they began reading words like something, mm-hmm. you know, on the very first day, or very early, they would read very big words, you know, a word like something. You've got your TH sound, you've got silent E's, you've got all kinds of things in words like that. They're much too complicated. I can see you doing it with small words that become obvious to the child later on. But there are really very few true sight words. Let me give you an example of what I consider a sight word. This word, I. But even the word I, the Y, you got an element of I in Y. It's not that far-fetched, you see. I'll give you what I would consider a sight word, but not really. In other words, you explain it to the child, the exception. Say the word to. Or the W is silent. The O in this case is not an A, it's not a short O, it's not a long O, it's an OO sound, as in the word do, etc. The T is okay, so he gets the T, and it's just this. But one of the reasons why we have a word like this is because we've got three words with the same sound. Two, two, two. And so you have a variety of spellings in order to identify the three different meanings of these words. But some of the words that are listed in the Deutsch sight vocabulary list are not sight words. They should not be taught as sight words.
I use them as, I would consider them like the most frequently used.
Well, they're frequently used, but there's no reason to teach them as sight words. They should be taught alphabetically in their category. For example, let me give you what I mean by categories. When you teach alphabetic writing, you make use of the fact that we have what are known as spelling families. For example, you start with the word in a short vocabulary, am. All right, so you've got bam, can, damn. You know all of this sort of thing, but you go down the list. Fam. Because even if this is not a whole word, It's a syllable that the child will have in multisyllabic words later on. So if a child can read the word fam, or read the syllable fam, he's halfway to the words like familiar, family, etc. You can go down, the thing is to take advantage of the alphabet take every advantage of the system that the system provides for learning it, you see. And one of the great advantages is its families, the spelling families. So you can do the same thing with A-N. And Dan, of course, that's a word they see in the supermarket with a deodorant. Can, Dan is a name. A, B, C, D, F, fan, gan. Now that's part of a syllable they'll read later on. Began, you see. G, H, han, Jan, etc. Jan starts at the beginning of janitor, you see. So they learn these things, and the thing is, if they can read all of these syllables, that's the important thing, is that they can master the sound system, you see, without any problem. Now you say, yes, you can teach them to read the other way, but will they read as well? Will they have that facility? Because that's the problem that we find out in the fourth and the fifth and the sixth grades, is that the kids who have been taught all these marvelous sight words, but have not been really drilled in understanding how to recognize syllables by themselves that have no meaning. Nonsense syllables, for example, which are very useful. Then, they really don't understand they don't understand alphabetic writing. They think that a word like, give me a typical sight word that you have been teaching a child.
C-O-M-E?
C-O-M-E. They see that as a... There's so little that is irregular in that is amazing. The only thing that's irregular is the O sound. Instead of being comb, which it should be if you have a silent E, O-M-E. Give you an example of the spelling family in the word comb. All right, you teach the child the word comb like that. First of all, you should really teach them to start with O. Long O in the silent E. Long O, consonant, silent E. That's a spelling family throughout the language. So you go with bone. All right, then there is no Rome. There is no word by the name bone. But it's not a bad idea to have the child read it. Now you say, you've come to this one. You say, this one is an exception. We pronounce this come. He says, why? We don't know. It's just come, that's all. But it's got all the elements, all of the regular elements in it. Then you go C, D, dome. Phone. Now, of course, there are other ways of writing phones. We have other ways of writing the long, the vowels. And we'll get into that later on, the different ways we write vowels in English, because that's our big problem. But you have B, C, D, E, F, G. Gome, F-G-H, home, H-I, well, you would use I-J, Joan, K. The child should be able to read these letters, because these letters stand for sounds. They're not there for decoration. These letters were invented as decoration. They stand for something. They have meaning. The child should be able to read J-O-M-E. As Joan. You see, that's what you're trying to teach, is the use of a sound symbol system, known as the alphabet, based on the discovery that all of human speech can be reduced to a small number of irreducible voice sounds. You see, that's what you want to get through to the child. The idea, the alphabetic idea, and the marvelous discovery, the great discovery behind the invention of the alphabet. That's exciting. Boy, you show the child. Do you know that every sound you make, you can put on paper by using those 26 letters? Say anything you want. I can put it down on paper. You see, that gets the child excited. Then he begins to understand what the alphabet is all about. He understands the true excitement of that great discovery that all of human speech could be reduced to just a small number of sounds. And it really is fantastic when you think of that. Everything we say is just a combination of the same sounds over and over again, you know, different combinations. And we can make thousands and thousands of words as not only of our language, but of other languages, just on the basis of that. So that's what you want to get across to the child. And that's why I recommend teaching the words in families, because then they can read anything. So then they can read any combination of letters that they see that are regular. You see, the irregular ones you teach. Go ahead.
Now the way now come there, since that is an exception with right. OME, they would probably be learning that one by sight.
Yeah,
because they'll say, you know, if, even if they keep in their mind that's an exception to the rule, then automatically they'll know when they see C-O-M-E, that's come.
Oh, yeah, they'll know that, but that is an exception of one. And once they learn it, they've learned it, you see. That's the beauty of it. Whenever you learn an irregular formation, an irregular spelling, you learn it once and that's it. It doesn't change. It'll always be come, you know. They only have to learn it once. But this exception confirms the regularity of everything else. It confirms that everything else is regular, so that they see, gee, this makes sense. It's very logical. It's very regular. And we do have exceptions, and the exceptions just confirm the regular formations of everything else. That's how you have to use these to reinforce the alphabetic principle throughout. All right. So I would be very reluctant to teach this as a sight word. I would teach it in with your rest of your O-M-E words, you see. And just say, well, this is an exception. It's only this letter. It's only the O. The rest is very regular. You know, why? Why? Because of a slight variation in the O sound, why should you say that this is a sight word? I can see teaching a word like I as a sight word. Or two. And even here, I would teach two with the other twos. Or the other two twos.
I have them all as sight words.
Yeah. You have them all as sight words?
Two, two, and two.
Yeah. The thing is to teach them as a group. Two. And tell them. Children want to know. You don't have to keep any secrets from them, you know. Even if you think it might be difficult, their understanding that there's such a thing as silent letters. You tell them it's a silent letter. They understand. It's a letter that's not pronounced. That's all.
The thing that the economy does that I think is good, right in the very beginning of the book, the kids learn how to mark the words. Like I could give my kids almost any word. They'll right away cross out the E at the end and they'll mark it long. And they'll go like home. They go huh, om, and they cross out the E. Right. And that's one thing that I think is real good about the economy.
Economy is a good phonics system.
I have the sight words, and that's, for me, that's about, I mean, if you ask me, if I didn't use the sight words, I would see a remarkable difference with the kids. Because every sentence that they would read, they'd have to sound out every word, and they'd lose a lot of their excitement and interest. I understand what you mean. They'll probably, if I did it all in word families, by this time they'd be so quick probably at sounding them out.
That's what
but
I
that
mean.
Would be very good too.
Sure.
But I think it's real, in every sentence, even with since I do give them sight words, in every sentence most of the words are not sight words. So but even if they can find like two sight words in a sentence, that makes it so they can read it so much faster because they get the thought right away behind it.
Yeah.
You know, because I recognize a few words in the sentence, and then they'll sound out the rest and they'll get it.
As long as you explain what the sight word is, that the letters in that word stand for sounds too. It's just that maybe one letter is different. You've got to make that very clear.
When I give them the sight words, we sound it out. But for me, the sight words, I guess I shouldn't even call them sight words. I should call them common words or something.
All right, why don't you call them common words? But the thing is, what I'd like to do is see the list of words that you use as sight words, or as common words. And go over that list, how many?
They know 120.
All right, but then they should be able to sound out all of them if they are, you know, not terribly difficult, because there aren't really 120 sight words in our language.
They do sound out.
It's very hard to find words that cannot be sounded out. I mean, I give you the example of I. And I have to rack my brains to find, oh yeah, there's another one that's sort of a difficult word, whom. But even here you've got elements. The M sound is regular. The WH, it's not flip, but you've got, it substitutes for H. And you've got your O, um, but you've also got a single O as U in two. So it's not an unknown thing to them. Yes.
Well, the words that I did give them as sites, what they really are words that they have sounded out and have memorized. So
right,
instead of
right.
just sounding, instead of always, whenever they see, and the ball, apple,
yeah,
whenever they
see
those.
All right.
If they forgot them, then they sound them out. But if they didn't, they were all right away, and they just.
All right, all right. Now, when you're teaching the word, say for example, the word the. If you're teaching the word the, what's wrong? Telling the child that th stands for the.
Yeah, they learn that in economy too.
All right, they learn that. Yeah, economy is good. I'm glad you're using economy. But I noticed in your room that you had all the Dick and Jane you had to discuss.
Oh, yeah, that's
just
the old
readers,
ones that were
right.
supplementary.
Yeah, just to read, but not to teach from.
No,
all
I don't.
Right. But I'm saying that a word like the E sound there is you know, it's an exception, but the TH is quite regular, so you could teach that as a quote sight word. Or a common word. Let's call it a common word. The word and is a perfectly beautiful regular word.
Yeah.
Perfectly beautiful regular. You can stop and a band, can, candy, dand, dandy, D-E-F. You can go through the whole alphabet. And I advise you to do that because it's a marvelous way of spotting, of teaching the children a lot of words in a short period of time. But boy, they expand their vocabulary. It's like dynamite. When you give them all of these words in the list, that all they have to do is just change that first letter because they know the and.
Even though I haven't done too much with the word families,
yeah.
I've stressed the looking inside of words, special analysis part of it. So if they would see and, like the kids in my room, I think that's real helpful too. If they automatically say, oh, there's and in there. They go, but and, band.
Right.
So that's kind
well,
of.
Well, I'll tell you, but structural analysis is bad because structural analysis is one of the terms that was developed by the sight type reading, by the look-say hieroglyphics type reading. It's not alphabetic. You don't need structural analysis if you know if you teach alphabetically. And the reason why I would prefer this method is because you also help them learn spelling. You know, you're teaching them to read, but you have to teach them also to spell at the same time. And the word family method reinforces spelling tremendously. So you've got to think in those terms of the benefit you're going to get of spelling, the spelling benefit that you'll get from teaching them in word family way rather than, say, structural analysis way or just haphazard or whatever, you know, as the reading textbook goes. Because you want to give them the idea that, boy, they an awful lot of words that they could make in their